Hello and welcome to Real Talk. You're listening to the voice of Vashon at 101.9 FM, KVSHLP, Vashon Island, Washington. I'm your host, Susan McCabe, and I'm here every Tuesday at lunchtime to talk about anything that strikes our fancy. Real Talk is the show that seeks to answer questions large and small, and today's question is really huge. The question is, how can we help our southern resident orcas evade extinction? I have with me our own Bill Moyer, who is the executive director of the Backbone Campaign. Welcome, Bill.
Well, it's wonderful to be back. Thank you so much, Susan.
And also Jacob Schmidt, who is an outreach coordinator for Save Our Wild Salmon. He's here with us from Spokane. Can you hear us, Jacob?
I can hear you. Thanks for having me.
Oh, good. Okay. We have all been watching with gut-wrenching pain the whale that we named Tahlequah. She's an orca who gave birth to a baby July 24th. That baby died within a half hour of its birth, and she has carried it on its back until a day or so ago. Is that correct?
Right.
To the point that the infant was decomposing on her back.
Right, and with the help of her fellow pod members. Some of them.
They were helping her.
Yeah, in the last week, I think they had started to pitch in.
So you, Bill, and the folks from Save Our Wild Salmon have essentially been listening to Tahlequah, and you have, as you said, seen her act as a call to action. Tell us about that.
Yeah, well, in my life, I haven't ever experienced this before. I'm not a particularly woo-woo person. I'm pretty down-to-earth and cynical and skeptical about these sorts of things. But, I was out of town, and I saw some of the coverage, and it seems like Tahlequah wasn't just grieving. Certainly she was, but it seemed to me like underestimating her intelligence by assuming that that's all she was doing. And when the rest of the pod pitched in, I felt like that was an affirmation that this wasn't merely an act of grieving. It to me felt like an effort at communication across species to let us know about the urgency of the southern orcas, southern resident orcas situation. And so it felt like Tahlequah was doing something that I'd never experienced before in my life. And so that urgency moved me to really ask, well, who are the allies out there doing this work? And how can we pitch in as Backbone Campaign? And because we'd been connected with Save Our Wild Salmon, and we're already planning to be of support at their fourth annual Free the Snake Flotilla, we're just going to throw down doubly hard on that and take advantage of this incredible moment where Tahlequah got people to pay attention. And now in honor of that and that sacrifice and that intelligence, I think it's really essential that we leverage this moment to finally break out of the political paralysis and solve the problems of saving the southern resident orca from extinction.
And I want to ask Jacob a question. I want to ask Jacob to give us some facts about what is the status of the southern resident orcas? How close are they to extinction? If you know, how many are remaining in Puget Sound, or I suppose it's Puget Sound in the Pacific. That's my lack of knowledge being displayed there. What can you tell us about the status of orcas?
So we're at a pretty critical point with these orcas, right? They've been listed as an endangered species for the last, I believe, 18 years. There are only 74 animals remaining. It may be 75. I think it's 74, though, which is an incredibly small number for a population of these whales. But the more concerning thing than just that there are 75 remaining is how few of those are female orcas that are at a breeding age, right? That are still like capable of producing the next generation of orcas. We haven't had a successful orca calf born since 2015. All the orca calves born since then have died qu- quickly, just the Eloquaz cast did this this last month. And so we're approaching the end of this reproductive window. Ken Balcom with the Center for Whale Research has been studying this pod, this J-pod, for the last 25 years. And he says that there is about 5 years left in the reproductive window of these orcas. So if a calf isn't born in the next 5 years, then that survives. And they're not just one calf, but enough calves to carry on a new generation of this pod. We'll just be watching each one of them pass, you know, as they mature past their reproductive age, and then just sort of winnow away one at a time.
That's horrifying. To give our listeners some perspective, Jacob, can you tell us how many orcas there were, I don't know, in the year 2000 or before that? In other words, how rapidly has this population been dwindling?
Yeah, I wish I had those numbers in front of me, but this is the 75 or 74 number is the lowest it's been in 38 years. It reached the lowest point it ever had just under 40 years ago, and that was after a lot of people intentionally killing orcas or capturing them for marine shows mm-hmm. around the world and around the country. But they're perceived as competition for commercial fishing or just a dangerous animal that we didn't need, and we didn't realize how few of them there were. And then, you know, in the 1960s and 70s, when they were being captured for shows, they pulled so many orcas out of the Puget Sound that got to the lowest point in the population they ever had. And they started to recover some, but never much more, until they were listed as an endangered species in, I believe, the year 2000. At which point there were, I think, in the upper 80s of whales, but like I said, I don't have the numbers in front of me at the moment. But
do you know, Jacob?
There really haven't been a high population of these orcas since the 1960s.
Do you know if any of those orcas that have been captured are breeding?
I
think
don't
that the number.
So. I don't have very much knowledge of that, of the ones that are in captivity. But I know that the Lummi tribe has been working very hard to get one of those orcas returned, an orca named Lolita mm-hmm. that mm-hmm. performs in Florida. The Lummi tribe has been carrying a totem pole across the country as a journey toward Florida with the hopes of getting the aquarium to relinquish Lolita to return her to the sound. But I'm not sure if Lolita is still of breeding age.
Yeah, right. So why? Why is this happening? What are the components of their demise?
Yeah, so there's a sort of three-pronged look at what the threats are to the orcas. And this is what the task force that's currently in place has been set to look after, but the three prongs sort of in order are vehicle noise. So with our ports having more traffic than ever, there's more boats going in and out of the sound, and that disrupts their communication ability. It makes it harder for them to hunt because they use a sort of echolocation to hunt. And with more boats going by overhead, harder it is for them to find food. Then toxics, so pollutants, particularly PCBs, which are found in a lot of our rivers and a lot in the ocean from different industrial manufacturing processes and just consumer products and things. Those have a direct impact on the health of all marine life, especially marine mammals. And then the third prong of it, which is the most important one, is the prey question, which is that there just is simply a lack of food for these orcas. So they're starving, and then, you know, of course, there's boat noise making it harder for them to hunt, but there's also just a lot fewer salmon for them to hunt. And so these orcas in particular, the southern residents, what makes them a resident whale is that they stay within 50 miles of the coast, which also happens to be generally the range of salmon. And these orcas don't eat sea lions. They don't eat really much other than salmon. 80% of the diet is made up of Chinook salmon in particular, and another 5% that's assorted, like coho and chum and sockeye and other things. But
so
Chinook salmon are really their main food source.
That's a misunderstanding, because I, for one, mm-hmm. thought they could eat sea lions. In fact,
we've seen video of that. Yeah, there are separate orcas that do eat sea lions. Those aren't the southern resident.
I see. And
there's sort of debate within the scientific community about whether it's a separate subspecies, a separate species entirely, or what. But there's no interbreeding between the orcas that do eat marine mammals like sea lions and the ones who subsist primarily on salmon.
That's interesting. So does this mean we need to stop eating salmon?
No, it doesn't, really. It does mean that we need to take some drastic actions in order to, and some bold actions, is that a word, in order to recover the salmon runs that have been dwindling. It doesn't necessarily mean that we need to stop eating salmon. I mean, our salmon fishing industry is very heavily regulated. In some places, especially like in California, they shut down the season entirely in 2008, 2009, where there weren't enough fish and the rivers were too hot. So the fishing industry there just stopped fishing entirely for 2 years. So the fishing industry does pay very much attention to how many fish are left and how many fish can be caught, whether they're hatchery fish, wild fish, that sort of thing. And of course, we have a treaty obligation to the First Nations, to our tribal partners, to allow them to fish and subsist on salmon as they always have, as is culturally and spiritually significant to them. So it's not exactly the fishing demand. It's the fact that there are the amount of habitat loss that has occurred over the last 100 years, with dams that were built that include no fish passage, roads that were built without the correct type of culverts to allow salmon to pass them. That cut off about 55% of Chinook habitat in the Northwest over the last 100 years. And then, in addition to that, dams that were built that do include fish passage, such as those on the Lower Snake and Lower Columbia, create a situation in which there are hundreds and hundreds of miles of reservoirs that then heat up in the summertime to temperatures that are beyond the survival threshold for salmon. So salmon and trout both don't like temperatures above 68 degrees. And if I don't like, I mean, they start to die in those temperatures. And this, I've been tracking the temperatures in the Lower Columbia and Lower Snake this summer. Most of those reservoirs all the way up that system have been sitting in the mid-70s for more than a month now.
Wow.
But, I mean, imagine the human equivalent would be, I mean, just imagine living without the ability to find an air-conditioned room or in an environment that's, you know, 125 degrees outside. And that's the sort of conditions that the salmon are dealing with. And unlike in a free-flowing river where, like a natural river setting, you have pockets of cold water that salmon find to hide in and rest. But in a reservoir, when you dam up the river and create a series of reservoirs for, it eliminates all those cold water pockets, right? It sort of equalizes the whole lake into one sort of mass that then starts to heat up and grill the fish in the water before anyone has a chance to grill them in their backyard.
Oh, that's frightening. You're listening to Real Talk on the Voice of Vashon at 101.9 FM, KVSHLP, Vashon Island, Washington. We're talking with Jacob Schmidt from Save Our Wild Salmon and Bill Moyer from the Island's Backbone Campaign about the plight of the southern resident orcas who are facing extinction immediately. We can do this thanks to Windermere Real Estate for their support, making our community information programming and our emergency alert service possible. Thank you, Windermere. So, Bill Moyer, you and the folks from Save Our Wild Salmon are talking about doubling down on the work that has to be done to help these orcas. What is the work? What exactly has to be done?
Well, it seems to me that it's pretty obvious that the Snake River dams have to come out. The four lower Snake River dams have to be removed so that the Chinook can return in the numbers into a habitat that's friendly for their existence, and that we don't have very much time to allow that cycle to play itself out in order for the food supply to go up so we don't have orcas starving to death, dying of malnutrition. And I do think that point that Jacob started with, that these are called southern resident orcas, doesn't mean they never leave the Puget Sound, that they stay within 50 miles of the coast, which means that they're out feeding at the mouth of the Columbia River that the Snake River feeds into, and that's one of the places where they would be, and along the coast, where they would be eating these Chinook salmon. So to me, we have to get past the political paralysis, that where nobody's willing to make a difficult choice. There was actually an environmental impact study done some years ago. Jacob probably knows more about this. That looked at the removal of the snake of the four lower Snake River dams. They've been called derelict dams, and none of the other options that we have are at the scale of the urgency that we need to act with. And it's not like we need to just do one thing and we need to be involved in this very difficult calculus about what's enough. I think we need to do more than enough to save the salmon, to save the orca. If our children were dying, we wouldn't try to figure out, well, what's just enough to increase the probability that our child is going to survive? We would do every freaking thing possible to maximize the circumstances where that our child could thrive. So that's what we need to do for the orca, and that's what we need to do, and subsequently what we need to do for the Chinook. And so Governor Inslee has been being asked to call for the removal of the Snake River dams for a number of years. I think Jacob can probably speak more clearly to that. Governor Inslee in March put a orca task force together. He had an executive order and chartering an orca task force that has over 40 or approximately 40 members. They're supposed to make policy recommendations that are, one, aren't binding, that two, they're supposed to come to some kind of consensus. I don't know if you've ever been in a group of 40 people or organizations that has had come to a consensus, but I never have. And to me, it's one thing for the governor to ask for a consultative body to give him good advice. It's another thing to sidestep actual leadership because of other, you know, whatever political reasons. It's time for the governor, in my opinion, to lead rather than follow, and to make tough calls, and yes, to listen to experts, but not to avoid doing what is absolutely clearly essential, which is the removal of the four lower Snake River dams. We need the governor and the attorney general to collaborate with the tribes and other stakeholders to solve the problems for any farmers who need to get crops to market, to work with the Bonneville Power Administration to figure out a new plan to replace any power that happens to be coming from those dams. This is something that I think is crazy. When people say that those dams are irreplaceable, or the power that those dams create is irreplaceable, I think that is absolutely absurd. There's never been a time when that power was more replaceable. And what's really irreplaceable are the orca and the salmon. This is a moral problem, and we need to take a moral stance on it and solve these other, you know, logistical problems because they need to be solved, obviously.
Well, let me put some perspective. Let me ask you guys to put some perspective on this. I don't know which one of you can answer this question, but if we were to tear down the Snake River dams tomorrow,
good,
how long would it take for the salmon to replenish?
Jacob, I bet that's you.
Yeah, I can speak to that. So, I mean, obviously, I can't say anything with like scientific certainty for that. But in the past, there have been some major dam removals and other just natural events that block salmon passage, and then that change, and we've seen that these fish are just incredibly resilient. The fact that they're still around in the with how much we've done to their habitat is a testament to their resilience. But so I'll point to two examples. One is that after the eruption of Mount St. Helens in 1980, ash and debris choked up some of the rivers in the area that were salmon migration rivers. And over, it took some time before that ash and everything washed away, but within months of that going away, there were salmon returning up those rivers that they had been blocked off from for, I think, about 2 years after that eruption. And that event really provided the theoretical basis for them performing large dam removals, like what was done on the Elwha River on the Olympic Peninsula in 2012 through 2015, when Glynn's Canyon Dam and Elwha Dam were removed. And there were a lot of skeptics that said that you can take these out, but salmon haven't been upstream for 100 years. They don't have, those genes are gone. They don't remember how to get up there. It's not gonna happen. Well, what we saw was that within 2 years, we're having just unprecedented returns of fish. So within months of those dams being removed, there were already fish heading upstream. I mean, for the last 100 years, there were fish just sort of beating themselves against the concrete wall because they knew that upstream of there was where they needed to be. Now with the Snake River dams, they're not, they do have fish ladders. They do have fish passage. So they're not the sort of thing where the fish are there waiting to access something that they haven't been to in a while. So I think that provides us even more, proof, like opportunity, even more, we should have even more hope in these fish to recover and to recover quickly. The habitat that's accessed via the Snake River includes the whole of the Salmon River, the North Fork, Middle Fork, and South Fork of the Salmon River, the Clearwater Basin with the Selway and the Locksaw. And like, these are nationally designated wild and scenic rivers. These are federally protected areas that some of which are full-on roadless wilderness. Like, the Middle Fork of the Salmon River is 100 miles of free-flowing, high-mountain habitat that, with no roads, no bridges, very little any source of pollution other than whitewater rafting trips, like leaving a candy bar wrapper around.
Right.
On the Middle Fork of the Salmon, they count the spawning reds. And in the 1950s, they were counting around 20,000 reds a year. So a red is a gravel bed where salmon spawn. It's sort of a nest for fish. 20,000 of them on the Middle Fork of the Salmon means about 40,000 fish were returning to the Middle Fork. This past year, they counted 250. Now, nothing's changed about that habitat very much other than some climate effects, but it's been wilderness since 1967. So that habitat's still there, but for some reason, 10% of the fish haven't been coming back to it. I think if we open up, increase the fish passage, cool down that whole Snake River corridor, allow the cold water to seep in from upstream and flow through the whole system, and provide that sort of diverse habitat, the tree cover, the everything else that comes with a free-flowing river, we'll see those fish come back to the Middle Fork. And that's just one of the many tributaries into the Snake. There's thousands and thousands of miles.
So are you saying, Jacob, that we could, like, in 3 years to 5 years, we could see far more robust Chinook runs coming out of the Snake River?
Yeah, I would say definitely within that time frame. Again, I'm not I can't say definitively. Scientifically, there are folks perhaps at the Columbia Riverkeeper who could speak a little more accurately to that. But
well, Jacob,
but yeah, I think within that time frame, we'd see just a huge increase in Chinook production.
Do the orcas have 3 to 5 years?
I think at the moment we have the 3 to 5 years is our window. It's slim, and it's going to take a lot of action, a lot of political will to get these things to happen.
And what can be done? To provide them with the nourishment that they're missing between now and 3 to 5 years, even if we break the political logjam and get the dams knocked down? How can people help? What can be done scientifically and politically to make this move forward faster?
One thing that can be done in the short term is increased spills at each of these dams on the Snake and the Columbia. That's allowing them to, or ordering them to put more water over the lip of the dam in the spring. That helps the juvenile salmon migrate to the ocean in higher numbers. because a lot of the salmon mortality comes with juvenile salmon, with baby salmon dying in the reservoirs, mm-hmm. being eaten by larger fish and whatnot. So creating a bit more of a current there in the spring and increasing the flows, increasing spill. This spring, we had a court order from a judge that required them to experiment with increasing spills. And so we'll be seeing results from that over the next few years.
But Jacob, I mean, isn't that instead of taking down the dams? If we take down the dams, we still have to feed. They're going to have to either survive on the existing Chinook population that is there, or we're going to have to become better at doing whatever, the Lummi were out attempting to feed with live Chinook salmon recently. And from what I heard on the radio this morning, it sounded as if they're not sure whether that was successful or not. I don't know that Susan, I'm not sure that actually we know what steps we can take to get to the place when those runs come back, but I don't think we have any solutions that sound like really viable solutions for the long-term health of the Chinook run and then the health of the orca, as far as I've heard. And one of the things that I found frustrating, actually, at that recent Wenatchee task force meeting, is that people in the policy area, they they kind of geek out a little bit on, well, if we let this much spill over the dam, then it creates this much more nitrogen bubbles in the skin of the salmon, and then we have to balance this thing out. So it becomes this mathematical equation when we wouldn't have the problem of nitrogen bubbles in the skins of the salmon or temperature issues if we would just get rid of the freaking dams. So I think that we have to have that as a bottom line, get rid of the freaking dams and do whatever else we need to do and beyond to make sure that we're making life of the orcas better. And we need to do that now. And Backbone Campaign set up a page, backbonecampaign.org/orca, where people can sign up. I was just out over I-5 this morning with a banner and a team of people from Seattle. They're going to go back out on Thursday. We'd like to have this happening, bannering at the overpasses in 7 cities around the state. We like to see light projection happening. That's one of the things, obviously, we do. We are training up folks to be kayaktivists to support the September 8th, 7th and 8th flotilla at the Free the Snake, the Save Our Wild Salmon is producing with all their allies. So we're helping with on-water banners, et cetera, for that. So we want people to, like, If Telequa spoke to your heart and moved you to action, it's time to act. So
what's the action? What's the action people should take?
The action is people need to make it absolutely essential, an existential requirement for our attorney general and our governor and our elected officials and agencies to solve this problem.
Now.
Now. Now, no procrastinating, no political, like, watching out for your political... Forget it. It's the time is now to lead.
Yeah.
We have 2 minutes left, Jacob. What is it you want to add before we have to unfortunately close this conversation?
Yeah, I'll just reiterate Bill's plug there for the September 7th and 8th outside Clarkston, Washington. Our biggest rally should be hundreds and hundreds of people there calling for the removal of these dams. Go to freethesnake.com to find info and register there and time to volunteer if you want to help out with us. But I'll say, we need pressure on elected officials that the order to remove these dams is they're federal dams, so it's going to take some federal pressure. Contacting your members of Congress, the governor has some sway with those people as well. So contact all of your elected officials.
Right, and the governor and the attorney general could put, and the tribes and our federal officials can all put pressure on the Army Corps of Engineers to remove those dams. The Army Corps of Engineers, I believe, knows that those dams aren't actually paying their way. So we can do this, and it's important that when we have an opportunity to show up. And it's, September 8th is also a national day of people's climate marches. And I would say this is a great way to focus on delivering a victory in our region for in a way that matters for our species and other species, in a way that other actions may or may not deliver results.
Thank you, Bill Moyer. Thank you, Jacob Schmidt. You've been listening to Real Talk. We've been talking about how to save our southern resident orcas who are starving to death. There's a whole lot more to this story. I hope you guys will come back and give us an update as soon as you possibly can.
Yeah, I hope folks will reach out.
Right.
Thank you, Jacob. And people can send an email to info@backbonecampaign.org if you're interested in helping out in the warehouse, make banners, or do actions.
Thank you.
Yeah, thank you for having me.
This has been Real Talk. We're here every Tuesday at lunchtime. Join us for some real conversation. Thanks for listening.
Thank you, Susan.